How Russia Trolled the U.S. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Russia trolled America bigly last year, meddling in the election campaigns. But did we actually set ourselves up for it?
In some ways, we sort of believed our own propaganda that we were exceptional, that somehow we were better than them. Somehow we were different than them. Somehow we were resilient.
Plus, two teenage pen pals managed to reach across cultural and religious divides in India.
They talked about all the contentious issues, but with the innocence and the understanding of a 15-year-old.
And South Koreans say goodbye to a U.S. military base and all its goodies.
Cokes and chocolates and ice cream and peanut butter, special peanut butter and jams. It's a really wonderful one.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us today. The end of 2017 allows us to put some things into perspective. Hey, that's one of the reasons you come to us, to see how this crazy jigsaw puzzle of a world actually pieces together. If 2016 was the year that Russian trolls hacked the U.S. election, 2017 has been the year of the evidence taps opening wide, showing us how Russia did it. We'll be looking into that in a moment, but first to Russia's own upcoming presidential election and why Russia's Central Election Commission decided that the most high-profile opposition candidate and a leading critic of Vladimir Putin won't be allowed to run against Putin. The commission ruled yesterday that an embezzlement conviction made Alexei Navalny ineligible. Navalny claims the conviction was politically motivated. Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow joins us. Just remind us, first of all, who Alexei Navalny is, Charles.
Well, Alexei Navalny he started off anyway as a blogger who was focused on corruption issues in Russia. He rose to prominence in the protest movement of 2011-2012. That's when you saw tens of thousands of Russians take to the streets to protest what they saw as illegitimate elections, both for the Duma initially and then for Vladimir Putin's return to the presidency in 2012, which became his third term in office. From then, he's really gone forward to then run a campaign for the mayorship of Moscow, which he lost, but he got a sizable percentage of the vote. He's certainly become a thorn in the Kremlin's side in the ways that he's managed to leverage not only the internet, but also social media in terms of like a YouTube channel. It seems to cut through this general ban on state television of his platform and his ideas, and still seems to manage to connect with Russians.
Navalny is asking Russians to boycott the election. What is his strategy there, and will Russians listen?
The strategy here is really focused on the turnout. I think a lot of people, if not everybody, maybe except for Alexei Navalny, think that Vladimir Putin is headed to a fourth term in office in March. So in some ways, this is the most unexciting race in the world. But on the other hand, it really becomes the question of how he wins. This election is more about legitimizing a fourth term for Vladimir Putin rather than just winning. And for that, you need a mandate. You need a good percentage of people coming out and giving, you know, Putin a sense that he has the Russian public behind him. One problem with that is if you're running against nobody, nobody really feels that they have to come out.
I mean, why wouldn't Putin, just for the optics of democracy, let one strong candidate face off against him?
Well, he would argue that they have strong candidates. There are certainly a slew of candidates that have arisen. And today, for example, we saw the approval of the candidacy of Ksenia Sobchak. This is Putin's goddaughter. She's a socialite. She's a liberal opposition member as well, and presents really a more sort of conformist view of the liberal opposition here in Russia. And she's essentially arguing for change, slow change in Russia, although she wants essentially the same things Navalny wants. But I don't think anybody sees her as a threat. She doesn't see herself as a threat to Vladimir Putin's rule or any chance of an election victory.
Would it make sense for Navalny supporters to vote for this other candidate, Ksenia Sobchak?
Well, one of the theories is that's what she's there for. So whether Ksenia Sobchak is her own person or whether she's in fact a Kremlin project is much debated here. She might be both, frankly. And so the idea that somehow she can appeal to some of these liberal democratic opposition members, to younger Russians as well, you know, it's certainly a possibility. And she's running a campaign. She's put together a campaign staff. It's just getting off the ground now. You know, the problem is you have these people who are invested in Navalny, these particularly younger Russians who like him and see him as their candidate. And by denying him this chance to participate and even denying him a chance to lose, you're alienating them from the democratic process and leaving them no choice but to go to the streets.
I always think of presidential elections as ramping up at least 2 years before they happen, but that's my mindset here in the States. Are there any Putin for president posters anywhere yet?
You know, there are no Putin for President posters yet. We saw the calendars for 2018 start to ship out pretty early, and it was President Putin for all of 2018. There was also a funny slip up actually from one of the state wire services mentioning a meeting that President Putin was set to hold with the Japanese prime minister in May of 2018. The only problem is that technically nobody knows who's going to be president.
Mm. We're about to talk about Russian trolls in the 2016 campaign here in this election in the States. Have you heard any concern from the Kremlin that the U.S. might stage some counter misinformation campaign in next year's Russian election?
Absolutely. They've been holding hearings in the Duma here for months now. Against the backdrop of all the hearings that we have in Washington, looking at alleged Russian interference in the American elections, they've had the sort of the mirror process going on here in Russia, singling out the possible interference by either the American Secret Services or by journalists here in Moscow working for various companies. And somehow the idea was they might try and interfere with this vote in some way.
All right. Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. We'll leave it there. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Margo.
So now the Kremlin is likely on the lookout for American trolls. Back in the day when America was trolling the Soviet Union, some of it sounded like this. Yeah, getting trolled by Billy Joel lyrics in the 80s isn't quite the same as meddling in an election. Of course, that was before the internet really became a thing. Once it took off, after the Cold War ended, American officials initially assumed Russia would be an ally and that Russian propaganda and disinformation campaigns were a thing of the past. Our European allies warned us to be cautious, though, and still we put our guard down, which left the U.S. unprepared to respond to Russian trolling and meddling when it did happen, including last year. That's a takeaway from a Washington Post article out yesterday, co-written by Adam Entis at the Post. I asked him when Russia picked up its disinformation campaign in the post-Cold War era.
For many years, they didn't really do anything as far as we could tell. It wasn't really until the mid-2000s.
Hello and welcome to our first viewers to Russia Today.
They launched what's called RT, which is their main propaganda channel.
A new international news channel from Russia to the world.
They began to, you know, enter markets around the world, and they began to create their own Russian language propaganda channels along their periphery. So targeting Russian populations in Estonia, Russian populations in Ukraine. That's in the mid-2000s.
Mm. And what kind of alarm bells went off among U.S. intelligence agencies as this was happening?
Very little. In fact, this was so not the priority after 2001. Russia and the threat of Russia was deemed to be not as grave or imminent a threat as the threat of Al-Qaeda during this period. So accordingly, our intelligence community and our satellite time and all the things that go with it were devoted to combating terrorism and not to focusing on states like the Russians.
And as you and your colleagues at the Post report, the real wake-up call came in early 2014 when the Russians annexed Crimea, this war starts in eastern Ukraine. The U.S. efforts, though, to counter the Russian operation at this point, your reporting suggests it was too little too late, like Voice of America's new Russian broadcast or translating Ken Burns' documentaries into Russian.
Right. So after Ukraine, that was sort of the wake-up call. They used social media in Ukraine in addition to deploying special forces. And the combination of those two elements was very effective in confusing the population, the local population, and in fact, confusing the world as to what was really happening there. And so that started a debate within the Obama administration about what to do. There were efforts being done by a few State Department officials who you just referenced, who were trying to make do with the limited resources they had. But on the side, and those officials were not aware of it, there was a deeper debate in the Obama administration, which continues to this day, whether or not the CIA should go back to a Cold War footing versus the Russians like they were during the Soviet Union days. And it was not resolved when Russia intervened in the 2016 election. It had been basically buried and not decided upon when they realized what was happening.
So, I mean, prior to Obama, Bush 41 was president when Eastern Europe and then Russia fell apart. And then there was Clinton, Bush 43. Were all these presidents basically just ignoring the possibility of Russia targeting the U.S.?
Well, I think all of those things took place kind of before social media became a real significant tool. You know, so you can understand the choices that they made. You're facing very serious, more imminent threats such as ISIS more recently, which obviously would take precedent over an amorphous threat that Russia might pose. Mm. And at no point in time did the intelligence community come to the policymakers and warn them in a clear way about what Russia might do to the United States. In fact, in some ways, we sort of believed our own propaganda that we were exceptional, that somehow we were better than them, somehow we were different than them, somehow we were resilient, and that the Russians, even if they did, you know, decide to do this to us, that somehow our society was stitched together in a way that would fend it off. And I think that was really the big surprise for everyone, was how vulnerable our institutions are.
So Trump has said that Vladimir Putin told him personally that Russia did not mess with the 2016 elections. He believes Putin. Let's just say that's for public consumption. Behind the scenes, is there any alarm at the White House that this probably will happen again and next time the U.S. has to be ready? Like, what plans are in the works now?
Yeah, so that's the big issue. Obviously, for officials that were coming in to the Trump administration, many of them were very concerned about the intelligence showing that Russia intervened. They believed the intelligence reports. The president feels that attention to Russia's activities in some ways challenges his legitimacy and his victory, which makes it harder for officials to talk to him about this, to get this at a high level attention. And the other issue going on in the Trump administration is the power struggles that are going on within it to control these key tools that could be used to counter the Russians and to follow through on the options that Obama left for them to use.
So given all of this stuff and Trump's unwillingness to call out Russia, how effectively can the U.S. respond?
As far as I can tell, pretty much nothing has really been done, except for awareness, except for the conversation we're having right now.
Adam Entis, who co-reported for The Washington Post the story Kremlin trolls burned across the internet as Washington debated options. Adam, always good to speak. Thank you.
Thank you.
In the fight for human rights in China, Wu Gan is one of the most prominent activists. He's committed. Online, he goes by Super Vulgar Butcher. Apparently, he once joked he was like a butcher getting rid of the enemies of human rights. Wu Gan has now been sentenced to 8 years in jail. He was detained 2 years ago after organizing protests outside courthouses and government offices and using social media and online crowdfunding to do it. Sophie Richardson with Human Rights Watch says he started his activism in 2009.
He followed a particular case of a woman named Deng Yujiao who had worked in a hotel and who was accused of murdering a man who had stayed there. And it was ultimately demonstrated that, in fact, she had attacked this man out of self-defense. And Wu Gan was quite incensed by how she was treated and the fact that self-defense was never even really considered in the investigation. And he started blogging about it and really galvanizing public opinion. And that then led him to become a fairly well-known online commentator and organizer of these kinds of protests.
His online commentaries were pretty irreverent. Wu Gan once photoshopped the faces of three provincial officials onto the bodies of pigs, then posted them online with the caption, "World's Most Wanted, Three Fat Pigs." His arrest and trial are part of a sweeping crackdown on human rights lawyers and activists launched under President Xi Jinping. Again, Sophie Richardson at Human Rights Watch.
I think one of the frightening hallmarks of the Xi Jinping government is that some of the people it has prosecuted with remarkable sort of hostility and precision, you know, are people who went out onto the street or said online some of the same things that senior leaders themselves were saying. You know, these are anti-corruption activists or people campaigning for transparency or better environmental regulations. But I think sentencing people like Wu Gan shows just how much the Chinese government and Chinese Communist Party want to control who gets to say what in public and influence popular opinion.
Detained activists often face pressure to make false confessions in China, but Wu Gan has resisted. A couple of days before his trial, he issued a statement saying he expected to get a heavy sentence for refusing to go along with a show trial. He's now planning to appeal his 8-year sentence. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Our friends at the BBC World Service have a weekly program called Fifth Floor. It features stories produced by journalists who work for the 27 different language sections of the World Service. So a lot of different stories from a lot of different people. And today, I want to share a story from the Hindi section with you. One of their reporters got a couple of school-age girls to write letters to each other, picking up on the great tradition of pen pals. One girl is from Delhi, the other from Indian-administered Kashmir, Kashmir being the region at the center of a decades-long border dispute between India and Pakistan. Here's a reporter, Divya Arya, telling the Fifth Floor's David Amanor about the project.
The idea was to look at Kashmir from the lens of young people. And we thought there should be an exchange of letters because of the anonymity with it. So it's about people who haven't met each other, but people who are informed by the environment they live in. So they come with their own preconceived ideas about the other person. And it's a real test of whether they'll be able to break those notions, those ideas, and empathize and understand each other's different points of view. So it was a test. We didn't know what we'd finally get.
And how did you choose these two girls?
It was very difficult to find them. The challenge was different in both places. In Delhi, it was to find someone who does not come from a background or a family where nationalism is understood in a very vitriolic and vindictive and anti-Muslim or anti-Kashmir way, which is the larger narrative in urban middle-class families, unfortunately, right now. And in Srinagar, in Kashmir, the challenge was to find someone who is, again, not very extreme in the way they understand the whole conflict, and also someone who trusts me, because lack of trust is something we struggle with most, because Kashmir has a history and does not trust the intention of the rest of India.
So introduce us to the girls.
So the girl in Delhi, her name is Soumya, comes from a really humble background. Her parents actually run a library for children who are disadvantaged and can't afford books. I went and met her because actually I was donating some books to that library. And I really warmed up to her, thought she could write very well. And the girl in Kashmir, in Srinagar, the capital, Dua, her name is, literally means to pray or to ask for something from God. Beautiful name. She comes from an absolutely different family, from a very rich family, lives in a mansion. And her parents had actually made a conscious effort to steal her from news developments, from all kinds of violence that is going on around. And her parents mentioned that to me, that we've been very protective of her. So we do want her to interact with this girl in Delhi because we think it will broaden her horizon. But we're also very scared of what that will expose her to.
And what kind of conversations do they have initially?
Well, interestingly, they found a common thread from the word go.
Dear Soumya, a very warm and pleasant salam from a place known to be heaven on earth. I'm a big music freak and love artists like One Direction, Little Mix, Zayn Malik, Selena Gomez and Justin Bieber. I feel that telling you about the music I love will tell you more about me than I ever can. The story of my life, I take her home. I dive all night to keep her warm in time.
Dear Dua, I got your letter and I'm very happy to know that you're also a fan of One Direction.
And what happened when they got into the politics? Or did they actually get into the politics of Kashmir?
They absolutely did. It began with a very innocent question from Soumya in Delhi. Do only Muslims live in Kashmir? And I thought, oh, this is a very loaded question.
But why could that be taken to be offensive?
It does seem odd maybe to an outsider, but it's such a taken for granted thing in India. When the two countries got partitioned, the Muslim-dominated states went to Pakistan and the Hindu-dominated states came to India. This is the only exception, and that's why it's contested. So the perception is that it's dominated by Muslims, and that's wrong. It's just something very regional, very historical, and not questioned enough.
And how did Dua, the Kashmiri girl, respond to that question?
So that's the interesting bit, because Dua, of course, corrected Soumya and said it's not that only Muslims live here. They're a majority. She talked about other religions. And then she gave an example of communal harmony, which is, trust me, not the reality so much. You know, we know that.
Not exactly the norm.
Yes, but that's their journey. So in the beginning, they're both trying to, you know, be the ambassadors of the different places they're coming from. But Dua opens up later. So to other questions, she doesn't dress up her answers, because questions then go into more contentious territory, like stone pelting used by young people.
Dear Dua, Kashmir is in the news, especially because of the stone pelting girls. Why are girls doing that? Are they really being harassed or troubled?
There were a lot of incidents where girls took to stone pelting, girls of Dua's age. And Dua was more candid in her reply.
Dear Soumya, A leading female football coach was teaching some girl students in a training ground. On the first day, nothing happened. But on the second day, military started firing in the ground. Naturally, the girls panicked and started to run, hide, doing whatever to save their lives. Then the coach, showing good presence of mind, picked up some stones nearby and started pelting, and the girls soon followed. What would you have done if you were in that situation? Please answer that question. I want to know.
In fact, she was confrontational. She said, I want to know the answer. You know, so it was re-emphasized. And Soumya replied saying, I would do the same.
Dear Dua, after reading your last letter, it became clear that our society is not safe for girls, whether it is in Delhi, Kashmir, or any other place. I'd like to tell you that if I would get stuck in such a situation, I would have reacted in a similar way to protect myself.
That's the beauty of this whole interaction. It keeps dipping into this common ground that girls of that age group share. But interestingly, Soumya told us that she had a fight with some very close friends after they read her letters because they thought it was wrong to talk to Kashmiris and it was wrong to talk to Muslims.
And that brings me to another question. You know, how do you go about protecting them? Because, for example, Kashmir is a place where an actress recently came under attack for an exchange with the chief minister. Was Dua or her family worried that she might get some backlash?
In fact, Dua's mother mentioned that very incident, saying that even when you have good intentions, you can be perceived wrongly. And the reason the actress came under attack was because she was being seen as taking sides. And I think their parents were keeping an eye on that. And Dua never took a political side, and that's how we wanted to present it. It's not about people taking sides about should Kashmir be part of India or Pakistan or autonomous, etc. It's about how their lives get affected with this decades-long ongoing conflict, which is why the letters talked about shutdown of schools. They talked about shutdown of internet. They talked about what Kashmiris mean when they ask for freedom. So they talked about all the contentious issues, but with the innocence and the understanding of a 15-year-old.
And for you, Divya, what kind of stands out? You know, what do you take away from this project?
Silly as it may sound, it just reinforces my faith in humanity. It shouldn't come from a journalist. I think we need to step back from what we do, which is look at things from a big picture lens. And when we look at them through the eyes of these young people and the kind of faith they can have. I mean, I went into this project with a lot of fear and hesitation, but it forged a deep friendship between these two girls who had never met. And it led to so much of conversation among so many people who read it. That just reinforces my faith that there can be dialogue, that this vitriolic atmosphere that India is witnessing right now can actually be dialed down by individuals.
Some faith in humanity. Divya Arya of the BBC's Hindi section speaking there with Fifth Floor host David Amanur. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, a refugee family from Iraq tries to build a new life for themselves in France. And that means wanting to learn French.
I want to tell them what happened to my people. I want to show them that there is a lot of pain in my country.
That story is still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Over the past couple of years, we've heard a lot of stories here on the show of people who fled from the war zones in Iraq and Syria, hoping to find refuge here or in Europe. And when we can, we try to follow up and see how they're doing. We're going to spend the next few minutes with a Yazidi family we first met back in 2016. The No family are from northern Iraq near Sinjar. They left there when ISIS began its violent campaign against the Yazidi people. Gene Carstensen first crossed paths with the No family in a refugee camp in Greece, which is where her story begins.
My name is Soham, and I'm 23. I'm from Iraq. I'm traveling with my family, my father and mother, and I have 7 brothers and 3 sisters.
When I met Soham and her family last year, they were living in Ritsona refugee camp in Greece. They were always busy, playing music, painting murals, studying, or volunteering with NGOs. It was hard to believe they had just fled a genocide. That's one of Soham's brothers playing the saz. The family of 11 children has lived together under one roof their entire lives. But the war has pulled them apart. One brother already went ahead to Germany, and meanwhile, Suham and the rest of the family are stuck here in Greece. Suham's mother is in despair.
Crying and telling us why we left Iraq if I cannot see my my child again. We told her there will be one day that we will all be together again, but now I don't think so.
A year later, I meet the No family again, this time in France. They've been granted asylum and relocated to the seaside city of Saint-Nazaire in Brittany, where they are living on a government stipend for now. Their apartment is just a few blocks from the ocean. Suham's brother, Salim, shows me a spot by the water.
Sitting here with sunset, it's very beautiful.
And do you play your oud here?
Yeah, I play. Sometimes we drink with my brother and sometimes alone. I just sit somewhere here.
We walk through a quiet, working-class neighborhood to their apartment on the fifth floor of a public housing project, where Suham is cooking lunch.
Yeah, kind of Iraqian and not, because, like, for me, I used to cook chicken meat with tomatoes and onion and these things, but it's both French and Iraqian.
For now, she's sticking with Iraqi dishes because, well, French food isn't so much to her liking.
Every day you will find hundreds of new kind of cheese. This is that, like, the thing that French people are really famous with, and also wine. So I don't drink wine, and I don't do like cheese, and I'm France.
Food is just part of the disorientation they feel in Saint-Nazaire.
We all been separated from our friends, from everything, so we are starting from zero. The language is different, the culture is different for us. But if we think about good things, it's the most important thing, that safety. So we have it.
Saint-Nazaire is a shipbuilding town. Most activity centers around the port where workers build luxury cruise ships. But the city streets are quiet.
We don't see anyone. We walk by the sea, some old people we see. So we don't like this. I mean, we used to see many people around us.
Salim is used to the hustle bustle of Iraq. He finds the languid pace of French seaside life kind of excruciating.
I think they are happy, but their life, you know, for us, it's like it's something slow, walking, slow movement.
Slow,
you know,
as life may be in Saint-Nazaire, it has a wild side. It's home to the Lycée Experimental, maybe the most alternative high school in France. The students wear whatever they want, design their own classes, and cook their own food.
French cookie?
Experimental.
Salim's younger brother, Suhar, is in his first week at the lycée.
So compare this to your school in Iraq. Is it different?
Completely different. I haven't seen anything like that before.
Where are we going? We're in a dark tunnel.
We are going to see music stuff here, where they play music here and learn how to make music instruments. You can see
we stand in a dank underground studio filled with odd-looking stringed and percussion instruments the students designed themselves. Suhar thinks their experimentations are cool, but he's also thinking about his own dreams, especially learning French and the effort that will require.
Yeah, of course, everything in life doesn't come just by a moment.
Yeah, and you're only 19, and you already know that, so that seems pretty good.
Yeah, it's different from culture to culture. For example, a 19 boy here, I'm sure he hasn't that experience as I have.
He also dreams of telling the French students about what his family has been through.
I want to tell them what happened to my people along the history, a lot of genocides. I want to show them that there is a lot of pain in my country.
Like a movement, like a hope, like a motivation.
Back at the house, Salim plays me some music on his phone.
On August 8th, 2014,
it's a clip from a movie he's making about his family's long journey out of Iraq, starting from their village.
I don't think I've ever seen a picture of your house.
Yeah, I think they have a picture.
Was it the one on the corner?
The family designed and built their house back in Iraq all together, down to the color of each tile.
And how about the design of the windows?
They were bringing ideas from internet, from Photoshop.
One night, when they decided it was too dangerous to stay any longer, they left. Suham opens up her phone to show me a photo of the scene.
So at 4 o'clock in the morning, we leave the house.
That's a small backpack. That's all you brought.
This is everything. And then
they tried to cross on foot from Turkey to Bulgaria 5 times, but they were always caught. Eventually, they made it to Greece by sea in a smuggler's dinghy, then finally here to Saint-Nazaire.
Have you ever had any regrets about having left your home?
You try to remember the good memories, but I can't miss my country. I cannot. They didn't let us to leave. They took our lives, so I cannot.
Do you dream to build another house again, or what do you hope for?
It's not easy to have your house. I was living in tent and I was saying that home is where your mom is. So for me, home is where your mom is. Home is where your friends and family there.
For now, their sense of home is still tenuous. If all goes well, they want to leave Brittany and move to the other side of France, near Germany, where they can be closer to the large Yazidi community there. In spite of how provisional their life in France still feels, Suham already feels an allegiance to her new country.
Of course, if I live in a country, it will be my country, and I will be always ready to defend my country. Like if I'm one of French people, of course, because they give me a house, they give me a safe place, which my country couldn't do it for me.
Back at the seaside, Solomon and I sit and listen to the sound of the waves.
For me, the ocean is always a place to sort of contemplate, you know?
Yeah. But as I told you, always the sounds just remind me that when we were waiting for our boat to get to Greece, same sounds, but what's really scary.
I know how grateful the No family is to be safe in France. But Solomon's words remind me that having asylum is not the same as feeling at home, and it can't erase what they've been through. For The World, Jean Carstensen, Saint-Nazaire, France.
We have photos of the No family back in the Greek refugee camp where we first met them and in France. You can see the pictures at PRI.org. Also, a quick update. The No family recently got their wish and moved to Fribourg in eastern France, much closer to the large Yazidi community in Germany. Jean's reporting is supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Tomorrow, she introduces us to a French man who goes out of his way to help refugees because of his family history.
Without war refugees, I wouldn't exist. So this is my personal reason.
We'll have that story for you tomorrow right here on the show. A lot of things winding down as we close out 2017. One of them is a massive military base in Seoul, South Korea. The Yongsan Garrison has been a headquarters for American forces since the early 1950s. But now the U.S. military is closing down the base and shifting personnel to a new headquarters south of the capital. Yongsan has definitely left a mark on South Korea. For some, it was a pipeline to Western culture. Some others are just glad to see it go. Jason Strother has our story from Seoul.
A concrete wall topped with concertina wire is the only part of the Yongsan garrison most people here ever get to see. But Shin Junhyun remembers when he was a teenage guitarist in the 50s, he was invited inside the base to entertain U.S. soldiers. Shin says he didn't have a clue about American music before he started gigging on the bass. But he says by listening to American 45s on the jukebox and hearing music broadcast over Armed Forces Korea radio, he got the hang of it. He and the others took what they learned inside the Yongsan base and brought it out from behind the walls. Today, Shin Junhyun is known as the godfather of Korean rock. Shin says he's nostalgic for the place where he got his start, especially now that it will soon be no more. The Yongsan garrison was like my home, he says. It's where I grew up and played music. It means that the culture of my generation will be gone, and I feel sad because it means I'll be gone too. The Yongsan Garrison influenced more than just Korean rock.
We see it as a window to see the modern Korean culture.
Daniel Oh is co-creator of Yongsan Legacy, an online forum dedicated to the Garrison's history. He says that the base was both a conduit for American culture as well as a creator of jobs because the U.S. military played such an oversized role in South Korea's post-war development. Oh is 43 and grew up near the base, but he says, like most Koreans, he had no idea what goes on behind its walls.
As if it was a black hole inside the city.
For Kang Tae-an, who also grew up outside the base, the best thing to come out of it was American food.
Fried apple pie. I love that.
She tells me when she was a kid in the 70s, her father had a pass that allowed him to go on post, and he brought home groceries that you just couldn't get in South Korea at that time. Kang says that made her house really popular with friends.
After school, all my friends, they're coming to visit my places and open my refrigerator. And all the stuff like chocolates and ice cream and peanut butter and then jams. It's a really wonderful one.
Kang now leads food tours in Seoul, and she says neighborhoods around the Yongsan Garrison were the first to have American-style restaurants and bakeries. The Yongsan Garrison has also inspired Korean filmmakers, like in the 2006 monster movie, The Host.
Start pouring. Pour them into the sink. Excuse me?
It has an American military mortician on the Yongsan base ordering his Korean assistant to dump toxic liquids down the drain.
Just empty every bottle to the very last drop.
It's just, these are toxic chemicals, and the regulations state that.
Pour them right down the drain, Mr. Kim.
It's actually based on a true story, except the part about how the chemicals created a bloodthirsty creature. Shin Soo-yun is an environmental activist with Green Korea, and she says The Host made South Koreans more aware of what's hidden behind the Garrison's walls.
Now, when people talk about that movie, it instantly reminds them of the pollution on the U.S. base. So when we protest against the U.S. military, we say the monster is still here.
Shin adds now that the base is scheduled to be made into a park, it seems like America is making her country clean up the mess that it's leaving behind. South Korea's Environment Ministry has found high levels of groundwater contamination in and around the Yongsan Garrison. The Seoul Metropolitan Government wants the U.S. military to clean the sewer system at the base before transferring the land to the city. When I contacted U.S. Forces Korea for a comment, they sent a statement saying that the responsibilities for addressing environmental damage are outlined in a treaty that the U.S. signs with host countries. The statement concludes, "Our number one priority remains ensuring the continued health and safety of our service members, families, civilian workforce, and Korean neighbors." Some of the garrison's neighbors don't buy that. When I met 42-year-old Kim Eun-hee, she was handing out flyers that detail how the U.S. military has polluted the area. She says it's hard to see any positive things that have ever come from the base.
The treaty is so unfair to us and gives so many advantages to the U.S. We feel there isn't much we can do to punish them.
To Kim, this is the real legacy of the U.S. military's Yongsan Garrison. For The World, Jason Strother, Seoul.
Marco Werman here with The World. Connections, something we mention quite often here on the show, how people or places here in the U.S. are frequently connected to someone or some place halfway around the globe, like this next story about a Roman Catholic monastery in Missouri called Assumption Abbey. Monks have been leading simple, contemplative lives at Assumption Abbey for decades, since the monastery was built in the 1960s. But recently, they've had to go overseas to find new recruits. Reporter Ryan Schisler was just there. So, Ryan, why is Assumption Abbey having to recruit monks from overseas to keep the monastery going?
Well, fewer American Catholics are choosing a monastic life and becoming nuns and monks. And so as the older people who have lived in these monasteries for decades age and pass away, they're unable to fill the spots faster than these people are moving on.
So where's Assumption Abbey getting most of the help from?
This particular abbey is looking at a monastery in central Vietnam where vocations are actually booming. They have the opposite problem where more people are wanting to become monks than they have room for physically in the space.
Yeah, so they've got a surplus of monks in Vietnam and they're coming to Missouri. How are the two communities getting along?
Well, I spoke to several monks there and all report good things. There is, of course, a language barrier at first, but a lot of the monks from Vietnam are picking up English. But Father Cyprian Harrison, one of the American monks who's lived at Assumption Abbey for decades, told me a bit more about some of the other challenges.
Certainly the diet, the food. Ours was not all that appetizing to them, and some of theirs was not all that appetizing to us. But there's a gradual blending that's going on there.
What about the new arrivals, Ryan? How are they finding it?
Yeah, they are generally liking it. But of course, the climate is not only completely different in southern Missouri than it is in Vietnam, but there's a lot of cultural barriers. And what they're doing is preparing in the long term to really take over this monastery. Eventually, it'll be mostly Vietnamese. And Father Thaddeus Nguyen, one of the first Vietnamese monks who came, told me a bit more about that.
The time we live here is the time for me to learn. To learn how to live in this society, and we have to learn how to live and how to manage the things within the house. And for me, I think a little bit difficult at first.
Does this mean that these Vietnamese monks are here in the States, in Missouri, for good?
That's an interesting question. They're on a temporary visa for religious workers that can extend for a maximum of 5 years at a time. But there is an option to petition for permanent residency after those 5 years. But the plan is to keep monks from this particular monastery in Vietnam coming permanently, yes.
So what's the backstory here? How did a little monastery in the Ozarks manage to connect with this other monastery in Vietnam?
Well, several years ago, the local diocese that this monastery is in closed the door to new vocations because there hadn't been a new monk coming to live here for years. And it was then that the remaining monks decided that they needed to do something to keep this place open because it is so important to the local Catholic community there. And it just so happened that at the time, a monk from this monastery in Vietnam was visiting the area, and they managed to connect with him and heard about the booming vocations there, and the rest is history.
Now, one of the things Assumption Abbey is known for, I have learned, is fruitcakes. Each year around the holidays, they go to work making fruitcakes, 30,000 this year alone. Did the Vietnamese monks easily pick up this tradition?
They have, and now the bakery, which is the main means of financial support for the monastery, is being completely staffed by the monks from Vietnam because the American monks are all too old to keep working at it. They make fruitcakes every day, all year.
I got to ask, too, with all the booze and an authentic fruitcake, that is cool with the Assumption Abbey officials?
They do eat the fruitcakes, I believe, though I imagine not every day.
In moderation. Reporter Ryan Schisler, thanks very much for telling us about your visit to Assumption Abbey in Missouri. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco.
Check out some of Ryan's pictures of Assumption Abbey and its famous holiday baked goods over at PRI.org. Okay, it's list time, that time of year when we run down some of our favorite music from the past 12 months. Mali in West Africa always seems to be a perennial hotbed of music making, and it is no different this year. In fact, we singled out three releases from Malian artists in 2017. That's good because it shows that the violence inflicted on Mali by a number of extremist groups in recent years does not seem to have extinguished the desire to make art there. So here's a taste of all three. First up, Trio Dakali. They teamed up with Kronos Quartet to produce a wonderful recording. And for our show director, April Peavy, it made her top five of the year. That's the title track, La Dilikan, from Trio Dakali and Kronos Quartet. Also from Mali, Songoy Blues. They've really come a long way since we first met them on the show in 2015. Their album Resistance was one of my favorites this year. It blurs the lines between rock and roll and West African desert guitar styles. And is that a disco guitar I hear? Songhai Blues there from their 2017 album Resistance or Resistance. Umu Sangare from Mali also made my list. She's tested the waters of electronic music before and different sorts of instrumentation. But on her latest collection, Magoya, Umu Sangare embraces it all. Umu Sangare stretches out on Magoya in a way she never has, and yet it's the spare title track that really took my breath away. Umu Sangare, one of three entries from Mali on the world's list of favorite recordings of 2017. We'll share more of our faves every day this week. If you want a sneak preview, though, then head over to PRI.org for the full list. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.